What's in a face? From a very, very early age, we, of course, learn to recognise facial expressions, to attach meaning to them, so important in our relationships. Until recently, scientists argue there were six distinct and universal emotional states identified through our faces: happy, sad, fearful, angry, surprised, disgusted. New research, though, in a field called human-centred computing is contributing to changing our understanding, reading all sorts of subtleties and meaning into the movements of our face and our voices too, I think, with some intriguing applications for everything from diagnosing depression, autism, and helping sports coaches improve their team's performances. And joining us this morning is Associate Professor Roland Gerke. He's a Deputy Director of the Human-Centred Computing Laboratory at the University of Canberra. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you on the show. What is human-centred computing?
Well, Natasha, the idea really is that technology exists for a reason. It's not just for some engineers to have a bit of fun and create technology. I mean, you know,
that's
nothing,
part of it.
That's part of it. Don't get me wrong, but it's there. Really, technology is there to assist people in their human life, in their making their lives better, the quality of life, helping them in their well-being, in their healthcare, in education, in learning, in security, but even in communication, in entertainment, in all parts of life. Really sort of are these days very much to different degrees bound to have technology in that. And that's really the idea. So let's not put a technology center on it. Let's put the human being in the center and now look where technology can help them.
Now, you mentioned communication, and that is so central to all of your work, scrutinizing, analyzing, interpreting the way we communicate with our facial expressions and our voice and our behaviors. What got you intrigued in the way we use our face?
Arguably, so the face is really the most important part of a when we have face-to-face conversation, or sort of if I'm, you know, interacting with someone right in front of me, then basically looking at the facial interaction, looking at also the feedback pattern. So not just the face, but also the head movement. So when I'm talking, I look for the feedback that, let's say, they're nodding their head so that I know they've understood me, and I can sort of keep going with our story. If I don't have that feedback, or if I see that they're frowning their face, or so I might change, or I might ask, you know, did you get what I was saying? Do I need to explain it further? And so it's very important to have that feedback, and it's really part of our the way that people communicate with one another. And we are really interested in what we call computational behavior analysis, so actually using computer technology to analyze and understand how humans interact.
And what sorts of details are you looking at? Like, how precise can you go? I know there's been work over the years on, for example, micro expressions. So not just the big gaping, grinning smile on our face, but also those sort of subtle, the subtle movement of the skin around our eyes. And we really are honing quite precisely in on the face now, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's in the right conditions, and so there's always, you know, you have to understand the context in which we're using that. But let's say we're having, we're looking at faces that's recorded in an indoor space with nice lighting, and so the camera looks at the face fairly frontally, then we can get this at a sort of sub-millimeter accuracy, really. Now, if you talk about doing this on a mobile phone while you're outdoors at nighttime in the dark, probably not, because you know, the conditions aren't right. So we have to understand what's the context in which we're looking at that. But you're quite right. It's so much more in these sort of small expressions and in the dynamics of it. It's not just the big smile, because, you know, that's how often in life do we see that? That doesn't happen a lot of times.
Not enough.
But we have more the small nuances, you know, the sort of little changes. And it's not always sort of the big amount and the big intensity, but it's the little dynamics that really count.
Well, look, what sorts of little dynamics? Because this intrigues me, because in some sense that means that when you're observing faces, you know more about us than we do ourselves in terms of what we're feeling and how our face is giving away what we're feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite a fascinating area, and it's it looks sort of at both the individual components, so, you know, what happens around the lips, what happens around the eyes, you already mentioned that, and eyebrows, and so they are sort of quite visible features that really stand out. But there's a lot about sort of the little twinkle in the eyes, so to speak, you know, the question of a real smile versus sort of a fake smile. You know, I can just pull up the lip corners and then sort of do a pretend smile. That's not really a real smile, because there's different muscles involved when we're really happy and we're really sort of smiling because we're actually feeling happy. And putting all these little bits together, so not just looking at, let's say, the lips, are the lips smiling? Well, are the eyes smiling, so to speak, as well? You know, can we find that? And can we make that combination and basically put a sort of an intensity on that as well and say, well, how strong is that? And how does it change over time? It's not just, you know, looking at one point in time and saying, oh, at this spot it is, whatever it is. But to actually say, well, we can see this continuous range, and here, you know, it starts off fairly with a neutral phase, and then it's maybe a 30% smile, and then there's, you know, a 70% smile, and that might be the maximum intensity that we have for that particularly smile, and then it sort of goes away again to a neutral phase. And can we have combinations of that? Of course we can. So maybe we have a happy and surprised face. If we, you know, I don't know, we just heard that we won the lottery, so we might be, you know, feeling elated and happy about that. We're also very surprised because we didn't expect it. Maybe we didn't even put a lottery ticket in and someone else did it for us. So wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. But you've also taken, so, I mean, let's look at one particular example, because you're applying this technique that you've developed to analyse our facial expressions, but also our behaviour, our voice, for example, to depression. And you've been collaborating with the Black Dog Institute and the Queensland Institute of Medical Research. What have you been looking for in the faces of people who are experiencing depression, clinical depression?
Yeah, no, this is, I think, very interesting work, because it's the idea is there, can we assist the clinicians in quantifying behaviour? At the moment, the diagnosis is very much based on the self-report from those who suffer from depression, as well as the clinical staff when they sort of see the patients. And there's always a subjective bias to that. And so about 7 years ago, the psychologist from the Black Dog Institute sort of came to us and said, well, we know you're working on facial expressions analysis and voice analysis. That's basically what we do, but we do that sort of subconsciously. Can we sort of quantify that? Can we put a number to that? Can we, in that sense, also make it repeatable? So if we have different psychologists, they would come up with the same number. The idea there is, you know, you might have heard about this sort of the frozen face, for example, for depression. So most people suffering from depression have this sort of, it impacts on their motor skills. So everything is sort of slowed down. There's just not that sparkle in the eyes. There's the facial expressions are much reduced. It's much more of a, not necessarily a sad face, but more sort of a expressionless face, if I can put it this way. And I think that the term of frozen face captures that quite well. So what we do is basically we kind of listen in and watch and record the video while the clinicians interview the patients, and we then analyze the videos and look at the amount of facial movements, the type of expressions, the intensity of expressions, and compare that against a sort of normative group of healthy subjects that do not suffer from depression. So we can make comparisons and talk about how severe is the depression.
And what have you found that's generalizable across people with depression? Because this is tricky, isn't it? Because you're talking about a very complex experience. Here you're trying to distill an objective measure of it. And it could be construed as being quite reductionist. But what have you found?
I think what's important to keep in mind there is it would always be very reductionist if we just said, oh, we're just looking at the amount of movement, or we're just looking at how strong the expressions are. We always really have to look at these in combination, so, and combine that with the voice and put these together, because it's interesting. We've done research, and some of the other groups around the world that are working in a similar area found similar outcomes, that somewhere around sort of 80% in terms of recognition rate for a computer system is the maximum that you can get out if you're just looking at a single measure. But if you combine, let's say, voice and face and maybe head movements and body posture, and so we can bring this up to about 95% in terms of agreement with the clinical opinion. So that basically says the technology that we've developed agrees 95% of time with the clinical staff in terms of the diagnosis there. And that's really looking at the combination and really getting a whole picture, so holistic picture, rather than saying, reducing it to a single number and saying, well, this is it.
Yeah, so it's features of the face, of the voice, of posture.
That's right. So it's facial features such as, the amount of movement in different parts of the face. As I said before, looking at the expressions, not just on the whole face, but also in individual parts. Are the eyes smiling? Are the lips smiling? Is there frowning happening? Can we then see the movement of the head? So the head nodding? Is the head tilted to a certain side? Is there emotionless voice, is it sort of very monotonic and I'm just talking very slowly, and or is there, is it lively, is there full expression? Are people using, when we're talking, we're often using our hands to express as well as we're going along. What's the overall posture? Is it a slumped posture? Is it nicely sitting up straight? Is it a relaxed posture? All of those combined really is sort of what tells the story.
And it's a story that opens up a bit of an ethical Pandora's box, I think, because you could imagine a scenario, and I'm being a bit Brave New World here, but where, for example, a prospective employer could analyse all those features and make assumptions about your state of well-being or your state of mind as part of their assessment as to whether you'd be a good employee or not. It's got a Big Brother feeling about it, hasn't it? How do you envisage these sorts of interpretations being used?
Our angle is really in terms of healthcare in particular, in terms of well-being of people. But you raise a very good point about the ethics of technology in general. And I think whenever, not just when we create technology, but also when we use technology, so in the end, the end user has to decide what they're going to do with a certain piece of technology. So let me try an analogy here. Now, I can go into Bunnings and buy a hammer. Now, a hammer can be very useful. I can use it to build a house or to fix something. And we would all agree that a hammer is a great tool. I could also use a hammer to harm someone. Now, is that the fault of the hammer or is it the fault of the manufacturer of the hammer? Most people would agree that it's not. It's the person who uses the hammer. They have to make the decision of how they're going to use that. And in that sense, that is not different from the kind of technology that we are developing here. So, we have to always look at what are the ways of properly using that. And as with any technology, there's always a risk of that technology can be abused. And we have to think about ways of dealing with that.
Sure do. Associate Professor Roland Gurker is with me. He's Deputy Director of the Human-Centered Computing Laboratory at the University of Canberra. We've only got a few minutes left, but I'm really keen to touch on two other areas in those minutes. And one of them is you've also been analysing those sort of stimming behaviours, if you like, they're called in autism, those repetitive behaviours, the hand flapping, the spinning around in children with autism. Why are you interested in that?
It's not really an extension of the work on the emotional side. So this is really coming to the computational behavior analysis side of things, where we're interested in understanding and again, helping clinicians to make a better diagnosis or perhaps an earlier diagnosis. One of the problems currently with kids that are potentially on the autism spectrum disorder is that often diagnosis doesn't happen until an age of about 4 or 5 years of age. And it's sort of reasonably well known and understood that if we can have an early intervention, so let's say at the age of two, then we can help them to develop life skills at a much earlier point in time and are better prepared to participate in society and to get along. So the question is, what can we do to make that sort of earlier? And at the moment, the often sort of the waiting times to see a specialist, if you're suspecting that there might be something with, your kid might be on the autism spectrum disorder, can be up to 12 months' time. You're lucky to sort of get a 20-minute appointment or half an hour appointment. So No, often the clinicians then find that parents come to them and say, like, hey, with my smartphone, I've took a video here of my child, and I think they're really showing this behavior. And so this might be a half an hour video. Well, we all know how busy doctors are. You know, they don't have time to, go through a half an hour video to, perhaps find useful information in there. So can we automatically analyze those videos and summarize and present that to the doctors?
Using an algorithm that you've developed.
Yeah, so that they can basically, understand what's going on.
Intriguing. Gosh, I'd love to talk about that more as the work develops. But what about on the sports field? Because this, just briefly, is a really interesting realm that you're also interrogating, looking at the dynamics and the faces of sports people.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, particularly in team sports. It is, it's one thing to have, so to speak, the body ready, the muscles ready, and everyone's fit. But it's another one to how well do they work as a team? Or in particular, if there's problems, perhaps what has broken down? Is it the communication? Is it that the hierarchy in the team isn't right? That they are not getting along in the right way? Mm. So from an analysis point of view, what happens in the team as they are playing on the playing field?
So you would be you're trying to film them as they're in action?
We do, yes. Yeah, right. So again, we have video cameras, and it can be, we're both looking at sort of the low-cost end for amateur clubs with a single camera and a laptop, as well as sort of the high end where you have multiple cameras around the playing field, and you're looking at it from different angles and understanding behavior, understanding actions, looking at the positioning of people to each other, the body language to each other, the communication between players. That's really an important part of that. And that's sort of feedbacks to the coaches then for perhaps the next match or at least for the training as well.
Gosh, you could see that playing out in all sorts of environments, workplaces and classrooms and all sorts of group and team contexts. Oh, look, we've got a taste of your work. I'd love to follow up with you again on the autism work when it's a bit more developed.
Sure.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Associate Professor Roland Gurker, he's Deputy Director of the Human-Centred Computing Lab at the University of Canberra. Interesting stuff, isn't it? Very interesting. And we'll pursue it a little further, I think, find out more. Well, on Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning here on RN. We're going to meet, another person with another incredible job. She's been working in a war zone.